Hey guys, it's Ed. Be sure to check out all of our content on YouTube. We've got a whole bunch of extra new channels and extra new content with Salim Razai and Peter Antevi and thought leaders in the industry. We're really excited for what we're sharing with you. Check it out on YouTube, and now on to the show. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Overrun Podcast. My name is Ed Bowder, and I am joined today with Dr. Tristan Glenn. He is the Assistant Vice President of Inclusion, Campus Culture, and Engagement in the Office of Institutional Equity and Diversity at Brown University, my school. Dr. Glenn, thank you so much for joining me today.
Good morning, Ed. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me. So we talked off air about this, and we've been talking about having this conversation for a while. One of the things that we wanted to bring you on to talk about was, what is diversity, equity, and inclusion? Certainly culturally, it feels like there's a lot of conversation about it. And the first thing that I wanted to talk about to you is, to your mind, what is DEI? What is it not? And then we're going to get into some data about EMS.
So thank you. And the way I kind of think about DEI is in a far more less mystified or complicated manner, in that the work of DEI is threefold. I think that one of the things that we do that leads to conflations and misunderstandings of DEI and the work that is attended to it is thinking of DEI in this synonymous way, as in using the terms diversity, equity, and inclusion interchangeably, as opposed to thinking about it in the independent manner that the effective work that emerges from that requires. So diversity is the process of diversifying a space, creating, recruiting diverse individuals into a space. The importance of acknowledging individual identities and lived experiences and the ways in which it informs, influences, and impacts the way they approach their work and how they engage with others. Equity is the process of attending to the ways in which the policies, practices, and procedures that govern and guide our behavior allows for spaces in which those diverse individuals that we recruit are able to be included and have a sense of belonging. So I kind of think of diversity, equity, and inclusion as simply the process of cultivating an environment or community that works for all individuals, regardless of identity.
And I think that's a perfect explanation for it. When you talked about lived experiences, I think that's something that's kind of overlooked for a lot of people. I think our conversation culturally, and certainly, you know, there's colloquialisms and policy that have become problematic, where, you know, affirmative action turned into sort of a triggering phrase for, you know, for a couple of decades back there. Explain, you mentioned doing the work, I guess, is the thing that I want to lean into on this. It's not so much about just, you know, hiring diverse people arbitrarily, right? It's not, DEI isn't an institutional thing so much as it is also a personal type of response to it. It's sort of broadening your worldview from what you've experienced into understanding that people of other cultures experience the world differently. Is that about right? Am I kind of getting the right idea here?
Indeed. So I think that to fully unpack and understand the complexities in relation to DEI, it's important to consider the ways in which issues related to DEI show up in our lives, both personally and professionally, right? So what is known and expected is that issues of DEI show up in our values and our commitments, the ways in which we engage with others, the value and the commitment that we have towards issues that are reflective of individual lived experiences. They show up in our policies, our practices, and our procedures. It's imbued with notions of power, privilege, and difference. It shows up in our institutional initiatives, which consequently inform allocations of critical and scarce resources. But it also shows up in what you're alluding to, is our conceptions of self and others, who we are as individuals, that composite of our morals, values, beliefs, identities, experiences, and on and on and on, results in a lens through which we utilize in our process of viewing others, our conceptions of self and others. And oftentimes, a failure to consider that critically creates space for us to, for our implicit biases to go unchecked, unattended to, which then consequently result in what we have commonly become aware of as being microaggressive behaviors, moments in which we believe that we're responding to the needs of individuals in our community in an affirmative manner. Unfortunately, they're experiencing as in harmful ways. So it's important to understand our identities, because to do so creates place to a far more systemic and structural understanding of how inequities persist. And the very fact of us owning and understanding our own individual identities and the cycle of socialization, the process by which we come into being and knowing our world and being known to others, is important because the social identities that we inhabit predispose some of us to unequal treatment in our society. And fundamental in the process of cultivating consciousness in relation to DEI is ensuring that each individual has a foundational understanding, a schema, and a conceptual framework for thinking through diversity in those ways. That, at what I believe, reduces the likelihood of DEI being experienced as, and I don't even like to use the word, as this woke agenda or initiative. That's not what's happening. It's not an indoctrination. What we are saying is that experiences matter, identities matter. And based on the ways in which our society is currently constructed, it is important to understand how individuals who identify differently have to interface with systems that have unfortunately been constructed in a way that meets out inequitable outcomes. So that is the and not what we have come to believe that DEI is, or some have endeavored or been inclined to try to communicate that DEI is.
And certainly that's largely a function of media just sort of, I guess, dismissing initiatives that are, you know, hard to talk about. And one of the most important things for a DEI is having those difficult conversations, some of the ones we're doing now. And certainly, you know, in the interest of transparency, we're both at an institution that has been pretty progressive with DEI. And that has certainly been helpful, you know, along my journey of growth and learning and all that. Before we get into the data, I do want to talk about microaggressions, because I feel like that's turned into sort of a buzzword too. And I want to work to kind of dismiss that, where, you know, I think it's easy to hear microaggression and think like, oh, it's a small thing because micro is in the name. But I don't know. In EMS, I think it tends to apply to, you know, simple generalizations. So you're going to an overdose, you assume it's going to be a person of color for whatever reason, or you're going to an alcoholic, you assume, you know, it's going to be a mid-40s white man, those kind of things. I think that stereotyping really plays into patient care. So take a second to talk about in the DEI world, what microaggressions are, how they, I guess, function in certain societies, and then we'll start getting into how we can fix EMS.
That is a good question, and I thank you for it, because as you have just referenced, microaggressions has become a kind of a catch-all term for all things unpleasant, and in many ways it has become an accessible way for individuals to describe the harm that they've experienced in terms of workplace or other interactions. So what I'll do is I'll first kind of offer a definition of microaggressions, because I think that oftentimes it's so heavily used colloquially that we assume that folks understand what we're talking about when we use the term microaggressions. And I think in a way that kind of minimizes the harm and impact and even the pervasiveness of microaggressive behavior. So microaggressions came out of the work of Chester Pierce in the 1970s in terms of offensive mechanisms. That work was then consequently and subsequently birthed into and informed Darrell Wing Su and colleagues' work of microaggressions in everyday life. That was a paper that was published in 2007. And what microaggressions are, according to Sue, the originator, are brief and commonplace verbal, behavioral, and environmental indignities that are oftentimes unintentional. But the difficult part about it is the microaggressor is often unconscious of the fact that they are being microaggressive. That's what makes it most pernicious and problematic, because They microaggressions communicate a hostile, derogatory, or negative appraisal of the target person or individual. For instance, you throw good for a girl. You're so articulate for a Black person. You really speak good English for an Asian person. Those types of intended affirmations are clearly experienced by the target of the microaggression as being hostile, derogatory, or negative appraisal of who they are as individuals. So, they are classified in three different ways at three different levels: micro assaults, micro interventions, and micro insults. The micro assaults is, you know, the kind of old timey, old fashioned racist behavior, very easy to spotlight. But the insults and the micro invalidations are a bit more insidious and more difficult to name when experienced in interactions amongst diverse people. And what they talk about in that piece are these associated dilemmas, one of being a clash of racial realities. And this is where oftentimes it's most emergent in terms of microaggressions. And that goes to the need to explore the lived experiences of those individuals who you are in community with, or who those who you seek to meet the needs of through your service. It's important to understand there's a racial, oftentimes a clash of racial realities, and that clash of racial realities manifests itself in pernicious ways that oftentimes result in harm for individuals in the community.
And it's not a perfect analogy, but I think it's the kind of thing where, you know, microaggressions tend to be sort of like microplastics, where they're, you know, they're around everywhere. We just have to be a little bit more aware of them to try and reduce whatever harm they can cause.
Yeah, and a lot of people who do research and work in this way talk about microaggressions as death by a thousand nicks, right? And anyone can be, as Sue speaks to, the feather that broke the camel's back. Like, it's a cumulative effect, right?
Right.
And I think it is important to create a level of consciousness, but moreover, it's important to create a level of language around how we talk about and consider and attend to microaggressions to create a more collective response and not so frequently leave that work to the target of the microaggressor to inform the community about the harmful effects of such behaviors through interactions.
And again, I think the important thing, and as far as doing the work is concerned, is, you know, the first step to solving a problem is admitting that we have one, right? So moving on to the data here, we've got a couple decent studies here. One of them is from our friend Remley Crow. Dr. Crow is actually involved in both of these studies. Where in this first one that we're looking at here, this is coming out of pre-hospital emergency care. This is in 2019. This is females and minority racial ethnic groups remain underrepresented in EMS. This is a 10-year assessment from 2008 to 2017. And the big pictures here were, and again, this was published in 2020, but what they found was, as far as the female workforce, it did increase 7% during this time, from 28% to 35%. Only 25% of new medics were female. There is a 5% population of Black EMTs, and only 3% of paramedics are Black as well. And in this study time, 2008 to 2017, Hispanic populations went from 10 to 13% and 6% to 10% medics. So even if we were to look at the entire population, people of color are not even occupying, you know, 20% of the space, and we're certainly not having enough female recruitment. So in systems like this, where, because what I tend to hear sort of anecdotally is, well, there's just not enough diversity in the hiring pool, right? We can only hire who applies. And, you know, if it's only, you know, white men who apply, it's the only kind of group that we can hire from. And I've worked in urban areas. I know that's certainly not true. There's plenty of people of color who can work. When it comes to a situation like recruitment, right, where now, you know, we have data, and I'm going to get to a second study that sort of confirms this in a moment. We have data that suggests that we are not a terribly diverse organization or a terribly diverse industry. And as I said, the first problem is trying to essentially find and admit that you have a problem. So as far as doing the work is concerned, when we see this type of data, we know that, and in our world, you know, there's always an EMS shortage, there's always a paramedic shortage, and certainly in healthcare, there's always a nursing and physician shortage. It seems counterintuitive that we have both a shortage in staff and a shortage in diversity amongst the staffs. So I'm interested in your input in that, and I'm interested in your thoughts on when an industry has this kind of shortage, what steps we can sort of take to start moving forward.
Yeah, so I think when considered, first and foremost, I'll say this. We know that a diverse, a workforce that is reflective of the increasing, diversity of our communities is critically important to delivering high quality, patient-oriented, patient-centered care, right? So the demographic reality that you reference further complicates the process of delivering such quality and care that is culturally responsive. So when I think about how to ensure and how to attend to these things in the professional space, the study that you referenced kind of gives some ideas or thoughts as to how we could go about doing so. Because fortunately, there are places that we can look to provide pathways or future directions as to how to attend to these issues. As an educator, as a forever educator, but former teacher, educator, and professor prior to entering into this space, my scholarship was in, my background was in diversity educator prep. And my work was geared towards preparing teachers to respond to the needs of a growingly, a student body that was growing increasingly diverse. However, according to national data, particularly from the National Center of Ed Statistics, 52% of the student population was students of color, but conversely, and oftentimes problematically, the public school teaching force identified as 79% white, similar to the demographic makeup that we're seeing in the healthcare profession, particularly in relation to EMS and paramedic workers. So in order to attend to that reality and the pernicious effects of that reality demographically, many educator preparation programs did a lot of what we're seeing increase efforts to recruit a more diverse force. Now, who can argue against the need to recruit more diverse staff and personnel? I think we all can recognize the benefits of that. But we also should be willing and able to recognize that that is a far more longitudinal approach. And that takes time. And while we're actively recruiting diverse staff, personnel, candidates, we must also be responding to the need that presents itself presently. Meaning, there's the reality of the cultural discontinuities between historically marginalized communities and mainstream white practitioners that emerge from this demographic makeup. So one of the ways in which I, and this is alluded to in the study, one of the ways that I promote that is consistent with gains that we've seen in educator preparation is to embed program level components that explicitly aim to equip emerging practitioners with knowledge, skills, and dispositions needed to perform optimally in diverse professional contexts. Because we have to look at these things in conversation to one another, in tandem, and equally invest resources in achieving both simultaneously.
No, I think that's right. And certainly when we talk about serving the community, and I think with a lot of things, you know, with any job, there's a certain element of, you know, well, I do this for a paycheck. But I do think in EMS, one of the crucial things that we talk about is serving our community. But I don't know that a lot of providers sort of reflect the communities that we work in. Certainly having worked, you know, in cities just in New Jersey, whether it's, you know, Newark, Camden, Trenton, and I worked in South Philly for a bit, you see that it often, and from the provider standpoint, it can be uncomfortable as well, being a white person going into an environment that I'm not particularly familiar with, that I haven't lived in, and trying to, you know, identify with these patients at a certain level that is just not achievable. You know, if I'm walking into, you know, a a lower income setting, and I'm with a family of people of any race, frankly, but, you know, people of color, that's not a lived experience that I have. And I think one of the most important things in as you said, having these conversations is that the diversity of people that you're going to see is actually more of a positive than a negative, where you can start to see how different people live in different lives and live different in different worlds, frankly. And a follow-up study from this is from Rudman et al. Coming out of Harvard, where something that I thought was interesting here, because we're discussing data, this found similar things. There's not a whole lot of diversity in EMS, but something I thought was interesting in this study was they looked at gray literature, which is just standard lay media articles, where 86% of these gray media studies talked about a significant industry discourse surrounding these themes, where it seems like we're having these conversations, but it's not necessarily translating into action. And it was distressing to me to see that there wasn't really a lot of, there wasn't as much academic literature as there should be. It was more, you know, just kind of people talking about the problem, which is the first step, right? But I wonder if I'm someone who's trying to, you know, run an organization, or if I'm starting to try and apply DEI initiatives, how do I guess, escape the, I want to say the impulse of just running out and finding people of color and trying to recruit them versus, I guess, purposeful recruitment, community recruitment. What's the most effective way, if I'm a system leader, that I can try and start implementing changes in my own system?
The way I answer that is go back to something that you said before you pivoted to this study, because I think it's important to raise that out. You talked about the value of being an individual who is in a situational context, meaning working, responding to a community that is inconsistent with their own racial, ethnic, cultural, and even perhaps even class identities, right?
Yes.
And how there is value in as the other or outsider entering into that community, acknowledging the funds of knowledge that exist there currently, and the process of identifying the appropriate course of action in terms of responding to the need. There's value in that. But that's not a place where folks just innately arrive, right?
Right.
That cultivation of consciousness has to be generated, right? Because oftentimes, what we see is that individuals enter into the space and their understanding of those in the community is informed by a sociocultural meta-narrative that is either inaccurate or incomplete, meaning their beliefs and ideas about the community are informed through media and other depictions that are not quite reflective of the community, the needs in the community. Doing that helps us to understand the role that EMTs play in under-resourced communities. Think of this. For many individuals in under-resourced communities, the role and relationship of EMTs to community members is that oftentimes EMTs are the first point of contact with healthcare professionals, because we understand that in many of these cases, due to under-resources and inequitable structures, that many individuals do not have adequate access to appropriate and comprehensive health care.
Yeah, and emergency medicine is disproportionately used as primary care.
Exactly. Yeah. So when understanding that role, I think it gives a different perspective and perception of the work. So I wanted to speak on that, on how it's important to have an appropriate frame when entering into the space. And that is important because regardless of the identity of the EMS or EMT worker, that essential understanding is important, right? And doing so creates opportunity for individuals to think about the work that they do. In terms of recruiting, again, it's important to be able to go to the spaces to get the folks that we need, right? If we continue to use the traditional approaches to recruitment that we've traditionally used, then we'll continue to get traditional outcomes in terms of our forces. If I'm an individual who's leading a healthcare organization or leading a healthcare educational experience and opportunity, what I would be looking to is to leverage lessons learned from other areas of preparation. Again, places, educational institutions. There are places in the academy who have moved this work. There are scholars who have done considerable work in this way. Again, culturally responsive teacher preparation is an area that is useful. That work, creating a culturally responsive practitioner preparation process, that work entails a form of assisting individuals entering into the EMS workforce and developing a deeper understanding of their own frames of reference, for example, gender, language, culture, abilities, ways of knowing, the potential biases in these frames, the relationship of privilege and power in our society, and the impact of these frames on their expectations for and relationship to communities and their constituents. How that is manifested, there are a myriad of ways in how we do that. One of the most exciting ways that I think of and am aware of is the use of technology. So rapid advances in technology have revolutionized the way we communicate and do business, including the way we approach educating the next generation of practitioners, educators, and what have you. Within this realm of technology, of instructional technology, mixed reality simulations offer one of the most promising pedagogical innovations, because mixed reality simulations utilize cutting edge technology and generate immersive educational environments that allow to attend to the growing disparities in cultural and ethnic backgrounds between practitioners and communities. So, and this is technology already being utilized in the healthcare professions. I mean, it's already being utilized in a way to explore effective skill development in paramedic science, to facilitate the development of higher order thinking skills in clinical health education, and to measure the long-term motivation among students in nursing or other areas. So if I'm an individual who's leading an institution in this way, I'm thinking about how do I achieve the essential function and task of attending to and assisting emerging students in deepening their own understanding. And then that work has to continue and be a through line in the process of actual workspaces. So creating a DEI curriculum that moves beyond the typical 1 hour training that we have, embedding this work throughout our entire process, becoming a part of who we are, because doing so communicates to individuals that diversity, equity, and inclusion is not something that I pick up and put down solely when diverse people enter in the room, but it is a process of becoming more culturally competent in pursuit of being more culturally humble in my response to meeting the needs of communities who are different from me.
No, and I think that's right. I had to laugh when you said the typical 1 hour training, because that's sort of the it's sort of the standard. And I just want to ask you one last thing, and then we'll get out of here. Given all of that, because something that we've discussed certainly interpersonally and off air is that a lot of the things that I think that make people resistant to DEI is that it is a longitudinal thing. It is work. It is something that you have to be aware of. And I feel like you hear a lot of that in modern and popular culture. You know, like, this is the new thing that you have to learn. Real quick, how do I, if I'm a leader of an organization and they're saying, okay, we have to work on these DEI initiatives, how do I resist the urge, I guess, of apathy, or to just be like, this is just, it's one more thing on my plate and it's not the important thing. How do I guess, resist that temptation to find other priorities?
This is something that I think a lot about. And I think in our community, there's differing perspectives on how to approach that. A lot of individuals talk about and have written about this need to generate the business case for diversity, right? I don't necessarily agree with that, Ed, and I'll tell you why. Because we don't prioritize making the business case for many other things in our work, in our world, to prove the legitimacy and relevance of them, right? So we do a whole lot of things that we just know are right to do that we don't have as prerequisite the need to justify the use of resources to bring to have that made manifest. I think what we have to do if I were the individual who's attending to, who are leading a particular organization, well, I mean, I do so now, right, in my work currently, in terms of helping folks understand the role that they play in the work of equity and inclusion. Going back to my original response that I provided you, as I hope to create a far more robust understanding of the work of DEI, I spoke to the need of having diversity, equity, and inclusion considered independently as concepts, as opposed to the interdependent manner in which we do, because doing so masks the work that is entailed in each particular area. So, as a DEI leader, I understand the most of us know and acknowledge what diversifying the space looks like, but many of us fail to realize what it then requires of each individual community member. So sure, we can recruit diverse people. We understand that. And that requires more of the institution in terms of allocation of resources for recruitment and re-examination of hiring practices and the ways in which we promote and advertise positions to recruit diverse people into the space. But it doesn't require much of each individual community member, right? The work of equity is where it requires the work of each individual community member. So as a DEI leader, it's incumbent on us to be able to explicitly articulate and cultivate a level of consciousness on how each individual member, regardless of their identity, has a direct impact on the extent to which the diverse individuals that we induct into the space thrive and consequently stay long term. When we talk about the business case, think of it in this way. I will make room for, I don't think about creating this broader narrative as to why we need to have diversity, but I also see value in using a language structure that most people can identify with, and that's return on investment. If we're utilizing our resources to get to induct and recruit a diverse force, a diverse workplace culture, then we ought to want to be committed to having some level of return on that investment. And how is that achieved, Ed? That's ensuring that folks are cared for, safe, and secure, because when folks have their care, welfare, safety, and security ensured in any capacity, particularly in the workspace, it leads to far more equitable and inclusive outcomes, and consequently, the sense of belonging. And when folks feel like they belong, they stay longer, right? So in terms of
they'll definitely stick around longer if they feel like they belong where they're at. And, you know, it's funny to hear those kind of things where, you know, again, we've talked about like the work is longitudinal, you have to do it. Something that we've talked about on the show is just, you know, do the thing. Which is, it's a very simple colloquialism, and just be like, isn't it just easier just to do it the way that works? And, you know, if you're going to come down to business, you know, we all know the phrase that money talks and nonsense walks. So, Dr. Tristan Glenn from Brown University, the Assistant Vice President of Inclusion, Campus Culture and Engagement in the Office of Institutional Equity and Diversity. Thank you so much for joining me today. This conversation is, you know, obviously ongoing, and it needs to be. I think that this is important work. It's an important conversation that everyone in healthcare needs to have. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today, Tristan. It's great.
Thank you, sir. And I appreciate you having me. Let's stay in touch and continue the conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back after the break. This episode of the Overrun Podcast is brought to you by Team Life. Your hands can save a life. Learning how to perform high-quality CPR can be the difference for someone experiencing cardiac arrest. Team Life offers CPR certification classes throughout New Jersey taught by trained professionals. Sign up today for CPR certification classes at teamlife.com and learn the skills necessary to save a life. Anyone can be a hero. Now back to the show. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Overrun Podcast. Danny and I are joined by Dr. Alicia Roof. She is working here in New Jersey with us, and she also has some EMS experience now that she's working as a physician. Dr. Roof, thank you for joining us.
Nice to meet you guys. It'd be nice to meet you. Like, I don't know you yet.
Alicia and I spent some time in medical school together, so it's fun to see her on this side now that she's passed and is working. So we just talked with Dr. Tristan Glenn for a little while about how diversity, equity, and inclusion affects medicine. We wanted to get you on to kind of have your take on it, because I feel like coming into emergency medicine, it tends to be a predominantly white profession in the first place. And I'm wondering, so far in your experiences working as a resident physician, what have you seen as far as like how are we doing with DEI? I guess is the first question. And then, you know, I want to follow it up with how do we think we can kind of improve things, whether it's in emergency medicine or EMS?
From watching Tristan's interview, you guys mentioned something that is very, like, I think prevalent, that there's a lot of talk about making these changes. And there's like a lot of like people sitting down and having conversations about what CEI looks like and how do we translate that into real life. But I think sometimes the translation from actual like sitting down conversation to actual practice can be a little bit difficult, just because that means you're changing entire frameworks of how people have grown up, right? Because a lot of like the things that you guys talked about, like microaggressions and those little things, are things that you don't think about. They're things that you don't even know or realize are microaggressions. And then being the person on the receiving end of a microaggression can kind of be like, it can be exhausting, right? Because it's, do I address the microaggression every time? And then every time it's micro, right? So
right.
If you address enough microaggressions enough, then it kind of becomes like, well, I'm constantly complaining about this, or I'm constantly bringing race up, or it's constantly an issue, when in reality for us, it's something we live every day. We don't get to like take it off and put it on and then kind right. of like go about our day, right? So as far as like how it's progressed in medicine thus far, I think that as with any movement that we've seen in the past couple of years, there's obviously been a very, very, very big push for it, but I don't necessarily know what that looks like, right? So for example, in residency right now, because we don't have African-American or Black or even Caribbean or whatever else version of like inclusion in our attendings, it's hard to speak to somebody about those experiences just because they're not available. And that's not, as time goes on and obviously we progress into our careers and we provide those mentorships for those that are younger, that also becomes our responsibility, right? But that's a lot of responsibility to carry on our own when it sometimes can feel like it's a battle that you're fighting by your own, just because others simply don't understand the experience of it. So
talk to me about, you mentioned that it feels almost like a constant wait. So I'm interested in that because I'm not convinced that say Danny or I experienced that extra level going into work, right? I think that there's sort of a standard that we expect, right? We're like, oh, this is just going into work. So how does that affect the workplace, I guess? Does it make the job more difficult, or is it just another layer of things you have to worry about?
No, it can make it more difficult, especially because a lot of times you don't, as things are happening, because we're in such a fast-paced situation, a lot of times you don't have the time to sit and reflect on every little thing that happens on the day, right? But then when you go home and you reflect on all the things that stressed me out today, or all the moments where it's like, I was at my peak stress today and this one little thing happened, is it that this is happening because there's always that extra... Is this happening, one, because I'm a woman? Is this happening because I'm Black? Is this happening because of some preconceived notion or whatever else it is? It becomes like a balancing act of constantly having to like check yourself and then check other people too, and make sure that you're approaching in a way that it can be received well, right? Because the word is microaggression, right? Aggression is still aggression, whether or not it's micro or macro. So addressing aggressions all day, every day is exhausting. And explaining it all day, every day is exhausting. And then it also gets to the point where it's like, I shouldn't have to explain this to you. There are certain parts of this that you have to either want to change or realize that there is an issue here in the first place that needs to be changed. And I think that a lot of people are at the point where in the conversation with somebody about all of these things that are going on, especially where race and DEI is concerned, it's very easy to come back to a point of, yes, this needs to change. Yes, I can acknowledge that my behaviors are this. Yes, in this situation, when it's pointed out to me, I will work to make sure that it doesn't happen again. But there's also a level of proactiveness to it that's necessary as well, right? So you have to be proactive all the time, the same way that we are proactive all the time when we walk into a room to make sure that you understand we're at the same level as everybody else, but there's always the kind of like a little edge to it, right?
And I think that's right. And Dan, when we're coming into work, you know, it's not something, like I said, it's not something that we kind of consider. And one of the things that that Tristan talked about a lot that I thought was important was one of the biggest things with DEI is doing the work, right? There's not a moment where you wake up and suddenly you're a bastion of diversity. To medicine's credit,
like I said, a lot of it is just that right now there's not the availability of the people in medicine to do it. So a lot of that change that's going to happen is going to happen on a lateral level, right? It's going to have to take me and my peers holding ourselves accountable for the next 50 years to make sure that we reach that point where we're making the change that we need to see lower down. So there's that trickle effect, right? So we need to be pulling in people from high school, from colleges, from making sure that these are spaces that they know that they can occupy. Because I can't tell you the number of us that have been turned away from medicine just off of the strength of you're not going to make it, or you know, maybe you should go into family medicine, or maybe you should go into this. Not saying things family medicine, because we absolutely know that we absolutely need more family practitioners, but that's the point, right? Is that we're being told to not occupy spaces that we're clearly needed, and then we don't go into those things. We go into other things, and we end up doing a million other things that maybe is not where we could have been the most helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's true in a lot of places where, you know, instead of kind of building people up toward, you know, having a better experience, it's more just kind of like, you're never going to be able to get there. Yeah. And Danny, you know, we've talked on the show before. We had, you know, the Kevin Hazard from American Sirens on. We talked to Jacques, we talked to Chief Moon as well. So I'm interested in your take, Dan, because we've had these conversations, and the whole story with American Sirens for the Freedom House Project, for those who are uninitiated, it was a project that was, it was the first EMS project, and it was predominantly run by Black people. And then when it became successful, they were all fired and they put a bunch of white people onto the ambulance, and the mother of EMS was one of them. So I think we see transitions like that. And when Dr. Glenn talked about doing the work, it's sort of something that we're kind of aware of, but it's not progress that we've made. So as an industry, Danny, how do we start sort of working toward this kind of diversity, right? Because, you know, less than 20% of providers are people of color. So in the field, what do you think we're looking at, Dan?
I think first and foremost, we need to recognize the pioneers of this profession and recognize that it's not Roy and John on the TV show, that it was Chief Moon and his colleagues who came out of the Hill District in Pittsburgh. And because of Dr. Caroline, they ended up basically starting paramedicine in the United States. I also think that we need to understand, we need to respect titles. You know, I think there's a issue where we have, you know, people of color who are physicians, who are nurses, who are advanced level providers. And for some reason, I don't know why, they don't get the respect they deserve. And that bothers me.
So I'm interested in both your opinions, because I tend to think that one of the problems in EMS is it's a recruitment problem. We have a generalized recruitment problem, but I really don't think that we're working toward diversifying the workforce at all. We talked in the first segment, there is some progress, but it's certainly not enough. And you know, there's always going to be an argument that, you know, there's never enough progress. But I'm interested, and Alicia, you and I spent time in school in the Caribbean. We've kind of been in different areas all around. I'm interested in your thoughts. And if we're trying to improve a system and we want to start from the bottom, right? How does that type of build, or what does that program look like in your mind?
I think that in order to get people involved in EMS, they need to know that EMS is available as an option to them in the first place, right? So, because if you think about it, for me, the first time that I had like any real healthcare experience at all, I was a scribe in the emergency room. And being a scribe in the emergency room, obviously you see all that there is to see. And seeing the EMS people, they were all obviously, like, and I shouldn't say obviously, but obviously a lot of them were white. And that in and of itself, you're going in, like you, I think you mentioned this in your previous interview, you're going into underserved in neighborhoods, and you're going into places where they inherently don't trust somebody that looks like you. And that's born of history, right? Like, that's historical fact. Those are things that we know come from.
Give me one good reason why a Black person shouldn't trust a white person. Give me one.
I'll take you to the hospital where we're going to give you all the meds that are going to make you sick and like all these things, right? Because that's the generalized opinion of healthcare, is that when you go to these institutions, you're going to get slapped with a fat bill. There's like all of these other things. And that's not to say that all African Americans or all Black people or all of those people or anybody at all is involved or is or all poor, right? Because we all know that that's not true. The perception is that collectively we don't trust healthcare, right? Because of how things have gone. So I think that knowing that that is an option as a job, and it's not just healthcare, me going and being a doctor or a nurse, that you can go into a hospital and you can become a tech, or you can become all of these other things that are not necessarily lower speckles of healthcare, would be helpful, right? Because if you go into the high school,
and you can work your way up.
And you can work your way up, but that's
you
not
a lot. You can start as a PCA, and you can do the work, and you can become a nurse or a CRNA, or you can go all the way to medical school.
But that's literally how John Moon started. Like his whole story was he started as a tech in an ER, and he saw, you know, he saw what the medics did and what they looked like, and he was interested in that. And I think that's an important thing, is you have to start with opportunity. Right. Yeah. And there's a million things that go into it. You know, there's advertising and recruitment and all that kind of thing that the, you know, corporate companies and corporations are going to worry about. But, you know, the first thing is, if you're living in a, you know, a majority minority area, or, you know, an urban area, you know, we're in New Jersey, we have Newark, Trenton, Camden, going to those types of cities. And I'm not just isolating those cities, because certainly it exists in Philadelphia and LA, where, you know, calling 911 means that a white cop and two white EMTs and probably two white medics are going to come help you. And I think that if there's already an inherent distrust, and if you have people who are coming into the community that don't really understand it, I don't know how that's not a potentially dangerous situation.
I also think there's an element of, like, for areas that are predominantly Black, obviously, like, you're going to want to see more people that are Black in those scenarios, right? But there's also something to be said for areas that are minority Black, right? Where there's nobody. There are no Black providers at all, because the majority of people around are white. But that doesn't mean that there are not Black students there, that there are not Black people living there, that there are not Black experiences there. And I think that a lot of time it can be overshadowed when we isolate, like, metropolitan areas that primarily has Black people, because that's where is needed help. But I think we discredit areas like where we are in Toms River, that has never seen healthcare providers like us in the ED, or had never seen like this. There's something to be said for that, because they're shocked when they come into the ED and they see us. They're like, oh my God, whoa, like that's a crazy thing. Like, like, oh, you're not the tech? Oh, you're not just here to do my EKG? No.
No, went to medical school and everything.
I literally said to all you, isn't that crazy? I know. It's crazy to me too.
And one of the things I wanted to talk about to flip this is, as a white clinician going into people's houses, I think it's incumbent upon us to learn the cultures of the areas we serve. Like, I deal with a lot of people who are French Creole. I deal with a lot of African Americans. And I think it's important that you learn how to interact. Like, you know, speaking to people with respect, speaking to, you know, the grandma who has CHF, you know, Miss So-and-so, and, you know, addressing her with some respect and understanding how they deal with things. You know, my daughter works up in an area where there's a lot of South Asian population. And, you know, speaking to the old women as auntie and addressing them with respect and trying to understand the culture is so important as a clinician.
There's definitely something to be said for that, because I know for a fact that you walk into the Caribbean household and you don't greet everybody in the house, it's automatically disrespected. I guess I should say, the points that you get for walking in and, like, introducing yourself or saying, hey, this is who I am, or good afternoon or good evening, or just like the basic acknowledgement sometimes is enough. And it doesn't have to be when we talk about getting to know the culture, we're not talking like going and entrenching yourself and like doing all the things that then become kind of offensive. Like, that's not what we're saying. Right. We're just saying having like base knowledge and understanding that the situation that you're going into is not one that anybody's comfortable in. You're not comfortable in it. We're not comfortable in it.
Right.
And I think sometimes we fail to acknowledge that we're not comfortable, and
it's just about trying.
Yeah.
Like, even if you're not doing well, like, they try. Like,
I had a patient a couple of weeks ago who's French Creole. And I was speaking French because I've been to France a few times and I know enough to kind of get into a story.
Your wife is a French teacher. Let's establish why you know French.
Yeah,
right? But let's
I'm
not.
Stuck, yeah,
don't give them too much. Okay,
and you know what makes a difference? Like just the effort, it matters.
It does. No, it, yeah. And it's felt. It's an effort that's felt. Your patients know when you make an effort, when you there's an instant shift in the room when your patients have reached the understanding of, okay, this person, all differences aside, is now a safe person to talk to about the things that are happening to me.
Great.
When I say that I'm weak, this is what I'm saying. When I say that I have chest pain, this is what I'm saying. And it's being interpreted in a way that is much better, right? You cannot always be empathetic to somebody's situation, but you can always be sympathetic. And I think that is something that is very, like, I think not prevalent enough in how
it's critically important and we don't teach it enough.
No, we don't.
And that's the thing that Dr. Glenn was talking about a lot was it's having the knowledge, you know, it's knowing what you don't know. We talk on the show about Dunning-Kruger a lot as it pertains to clinical medicine, but it really is that. It's, you know, if you've never lived in a house of, you know, of mixed cultures or mixed races, it's very difficult to try to imagine what that's like. And, you know, we can flip it too, where if, you know, lacking the diversity among staff, you can hire people of color on staff and also have them go into predominantly white neighborhoods. And that causes a whole different paradigm shift in the actual, you know, the cultures that are interacting. So I do think that one of the most important things is just having conversations like this, which I know sounds so trite, but it's also the thing, like it's acknowledging that it exists and trying to work to make things better. There's always going to be, I think, generational problems that is going to be very hard to overcome because, I mean, there's just people that were raised a certain way. And I know that that's a very bad excuse. But, you know, you're going to run into places. Alicia, you spend time in the South. You know that you're going to run into people where it's like, that's just how I am. But Alicia, we're going to give you the last word here. If you have... You have one message to spend or to send to EMS workers, emergency workers who are looking to join either to build in medicine or looking to join medicine at all. What are your words to people of color, people in disenfranchised communities who are looking into this type of profession?
I think that in healthcare, it's one of the biggest things that I've learned that helps me kind of get through it is to remember like and show up as yourself. Right? Show up as who you are. If you like the optimal version of yourself that you can be, that's who you need to show up as in healthcare, right? Like, because anything less, you're doing a disservice to a certain extent. And we do our very best to like maintain our health at home and our welfare and all of those things so that we can show up for our best for you. And sometimes I think we need to operate with a little bit more kindness and hope that if everybody is showing up at their best, that kindness will kind of help us all through.
I think that's a perfect place to leave. Always start with kindness, end with kindness. Dr. Alicia Roof, thank you so much for joining us. Guys, make sure you like and subscribe down below. Check out the rest of our videos and podcasts for The Overrun. I'm Ed Bowder.
I'm Dan Schwester.
And we'll talk to you all next time.